Dinner was served for three at Dracula's house by the sea. The hors d'oeuvres were fine, but I choked on my wine when I learned that the main course was me. A vampire named Perkins was so very fond of small gherkins. While she served the tea, she ate 43, which pickled her internal workings. Go on the left with the pitchforks. Igor, Igor. What a swimmer is Dracula's daughter. But her pool looks more red than the water. The blood stains the boat, but it's easy to float, 'cause blood is much thicker than water. Transylvania. For dessert, there was batwing confetti and the veins of a mummy named Betty. I first frowned upon it, but with ketchup on it, it tasted very much like spaghetti.
Don't let the song throw you. You are listening to Wonder Mag on Air with Denny Reese, and this is episode 81. I was trying to put you in the mood for my special guest today, Dacre Stoker, the great grandnephew of Bram Stoker, the author of the original Dracula. And of course, that interview is coming right up. Well, this is my much anticipated interview with Dacre Stoker. I want to make sure I say that name right. I hope I have. How you doing this afternoon, Dacre?
Denny, I'm doing great. Thank you so much. And you did get it right. You know, it's an interesting name, and it gets kind of changed around an awful lot in my life. But you got it right today.
Well, I was afraid I might get the first name right and the last name wrong, or the first name right and the last, you know, some way, anyway. Anyway, you're an author in your own right, but you're also a relative of someone very famous, especially this time of year with Halloween coming up. And I wanted to talk to you. I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time, but you are the great grandnephew of Bram Stoker.
That is correct. It is our time of year. I kind of joke the Stoker family. It's sort of our Super Bowl month. Everybody seems to focus their attention on the dark, the macabre, of course, Dracula, and anything to do with horror. But my connection is such. Bram was one of seven children, large family. He was the third in line. And his youngest brother, George, my great-grandfather, and funnily enough, though, Denny, only three of the children of the seven actually had offspring, and only two of those lines still have active offspring. And luckily, one of them is mine, mm-hmm. and the other is Bram's. So there are actually two great-grandsons still alive, Bram's direct lineage, and they all have children. So we chat a lot, compare notes, and they're very helpful in presenting me all kinds of interesting information, because I seem to be the only one that's really following through on promoting Bram's legacy in this day and age.
Yeah, so just to be clear, what year was he born?
1947.
47.
Which was actually known as, ironically, Black 47 in Dublin, Ireland, when they were just sort of coming out of cholera epidemics and potato famine. So it was not a great time for someone to be born, but rather ironic that it's a young Bram Stoker that gets born in Black 47.
Yeah, and he lived into the 20th century, right? But not too long.
Yeah, he died 1912.
1912.
Titanic went down.
Oh, in April.
Yep.
Okay. So you say now you became aware, you knew you know who he was, I guess, because you'd probably heard of Dracula at an early age. So I'm sure you, when you found out you were related to him in that way, you really wanted to find out as much as you could.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting. I have had the opportunity to chat with, you know, people who were descendants of other celebrities in the literary world or the sporting world, that sort of thing. And, you know, sometimes you just sort of take it for granted. Or you just don't want to really thump your chest and say, hey, I'm a relative of Bram Stoker here. Mm-hmm. Treat me differently. And that, growing up in Montreal, Canada, you know, really what raised the awareness for me was around Halloween, when my friends would joke at my expense and say, you know, what's going to happen if we become the Stokers for trick or treat? Are you gonna take our blood or give us candy? And, you know, you get a good shot. And finally, about the age of 12, I asked my dad, you know, what's this all about? And, you know, he didn't know a whole lot about Bram's story. Matter of fact, not a lot of people did back in those days. This was sort of the, you know, 60s and early 70s. But he did pull a book off the bookshelf, and it was the first edition of Dracula that Bram had actually signed to his mom. And I read that a little bit later on, but the book that really made an impression on me that my dad got was a book by McNally and Florescu, who wrote In Search of Dracula. It came out in the late 70s, and mm-hmm. They're the guys that actually found the Dracula notes in the Rosebud Museum. They're the guys that actually connected the historical Vlad Dracula to Bram's research, because once they found the notes, Bram's 125 pages of notes in the Rosebud Museum in Philadelphia, that sort of opened up the doors to Dracula scholarly endeavor. And that's when people really started analyzing the novel, because now they had behind the curtain, so to speak, of look at the book and what went into Bram's thinking and his research.
Okay, I want to get into how well the book was received when it was published, but I want to talk about, first I want to get into Bram's background, about how he was raised, and he had an interesting life before he ever started writing, isn't that right?
And I'm glad you're starting here, because not many people do. You know, he's not just the author of Dracula. He was a sickly young child, the number three in line. He wasn't expected to survive. We don't know what his childhood illness was. He's still a bit undiagnosed, and there's not a lot of information you know, about the family. A lot of things get lost. But as I said, one of seven children, he was sick until that, you know, almost invalid. He did write in one book, he wrote about his boss, Henry Irving. And he said, I had a very unusual childhood, never knew what it was like to stand upright at the age of seven.
Wow.
Thought I was going to have my last breath. He used to ring a bell to have my mother come and help. So wasn't sure what caused it. I had my suspicions are respiratory allergies and asthma, because he grew out of the illness at later, after 7 years of old, and ended up becoming a champion athlete when he went to university at Trinity College in Dublin. So he caught up for lost time. He was tutored. He got lots of stories kind of thrown at him, and the way his mom and his nanny kept him educated and interested by telling him all kinds of stories of folklore, Irish stories, mythology, and then he did, as I said, his formal tutoring so he could write his exams and get into Trinity College, at which time he flourished. He grew to be 6'2", a really big stud athlete on campus, won all sorts of awards in different sports that he played, from rowing to gymnastics to rugby to long distance running. And he also became sort of a big man on campus. He was the head of the Philosophical Society and the Historical Society, and he ended up getting a master's in mathematics. But at the same time, he was also pushed into action to actually work at his seat of the British government, which was called Dublin Castle, where his dad had retired from. And Bran took on a very, you know, didn't seem like a super important job, but it was. It was a clerk in the Petty Sessions legal department. And in typical Bran Stoker fashion, he realized there was a lot of inconsistencies with the way that the laws were handed out for minor crimes like stealing, that sort of thing, home invasion, and things like that. And so he actually wrote a manual on his own. He went to his bosses, asked him to do it on his own nickel, wrote a manual, and it sold to all the legal courts in Ireland, and it was used up until the 1960s. So he was a man of great focus and endeavor, but behind that, he was also a budding writer and loved the theater. And I can say that with great conviction, Denny, because I was lucky enough to find in his great-grandson's attic an actual diary. They actually call it journal, mm-hmm. but a journal that Bran kept during those years. And I could see him practicing poetry, some of it romantic, some of it horrifying, some of it just pure, interesting observations that he would make in everyday life, both at Dublin Castle and out on the streets and the pubs and so on. So he was collecting interesting, cool thoughts to compile in this book that later on, when he started writing formally, he would use these thoughts and observations in these stories.
Now, you mentioned Henry Irving. That was a famous actor at the time. He worked for him, right?
Yeah, that was a huge break that Bran got. He also was writing theatrical reviews for a newspaper, the Dublin Evening Mail. And because of one review that he wrote of the famous Henry Irving, who came to Dublin to play in Hamlet, Irving said, "I got to meet that young man who wrote such a great review," and they had dinner together at the Shelburne Hotel, and it was famous because they spent all evening together regaling about all sorts of poetry and plans for the theater, and Irving was so impressed with Bran and vice versa that Irving offered him a job, and it was interesting because Irving at that time had just taken over control of the Lyceum Theater, which was the first time an actor had actually done that, but he was famous enough to be able to do it, and obviously convinced the banks to loan him some money. But he realized he needed a man like Bran, who had these attributes that I just mentioned, loved the theater and the creativity, but was a good number cruncher, somebody who could keep the books and keep everybody on the straight and narrow. And that was the huge break that my great-granduncle needed to really remove him from a rather conservative environment, which was being a clerk in the Petty Sessions legal department, finishes his degrees at Trinity, marry his sweetheart, and head off to London, which was when the world really sort of opened its arms to Bran, the writer, and Bran, the theater man, and really, as they say, you know, the rest is history. This is where he, you know, wrote books and met all kinds of famous people and so on.
Now, he wrote a book about Irving, right? And that was probably his bestseller.
You're right. You know, sadly, his span of work with Irving lasted only 27 years. Irving died from some heart ailment, and Bran was sort of left without a job, without a pension. But luckily, on the side, Bran was writing on holidays, and he wrote this book called The Personal Reminiscence of Henry Irving. It's a two-volume book, and it was an immediate bestseller. Denny, it's kind of like if you or I were the manager of George Clooney or Brad Pitt or somebody, mm-hmm. and then he died tragically, and we write the tell-all book. But it was very tasteful, but it was something people really wanted to hear is, you know, the famous Henry Irving. He was actually the first actor ever knighted. So this was a big deal. And so when Bran sold that book, he made a good amount of money on that, which helped him in the latter years of his life.
And then today, more people have heard of Bram Stoker than Henry Irving.
That is true. You know, it's interesting. At the time, Bram was sort of the man in the shadows that created the right environment, did all the dog's body work for Irving, kept the Lyceum Theater working just right so Irving could be his magnificent creative self. And later on, you know, Bram eclipsed Irving with a novel, Dracula, written between 1890 and 1897.
Okay.
Ironically, he had been thinking of turning the book into a stage play. He actually had a stage reading to protect the dramatic rights of it at the Lightning Theater. It wasn't a formal production. It had to appear as one. They had two people in the audience, and there was only one script to be passed around. But Harry Irving watched part of that, and he sort of threw up his hands and said, "Dreadful," as if he rejected it. And for one reason or another, I think that was a sign that Irving was getting on. It was later in his career, and that he was not really excited about Bram Stoker emerging from the, you know, into the limelight, so to speak, mm-hmm. with this book that was about to be published in 6 or 7 days. And Irving was right. This thing was actually quite well received. A lot of folks don't know this, because up until about 3, 4, 5 years ago, the common word was that Dracula was only met with mixed reviews, which was accurate, but the biographers only used a very small sample of book reviews to base that statement. And I believe they were only six reviews. Well, a good friend of mine, a professor now at Savannah College of Art and Design in Atlanta, Professor John Edgar Browning, has written a book, The Forgotten Writings of Bram Stoker, and he has found over 100 reviews. This is because of digitization of libraries and archives and so on. And the vast majority of these reviews were very positive. So, yes, it was still met with a few mixed reviews, but the vast majority were positive. What was mixed about it, Denny, was it was horrifying. And there were people in the press and readers in London who were just blown away by the amount of horror and the reality of this book. Dracula, if those of listeners who haven't read it or just watched movies, it was made to feel that it was happening in real time. So for those of you that have ever watched the Blair Witch Project, when that kind of rocked everybody watching that sort of real-time movie, people thought it was real. The War of the Worlds was another one mm-hmm. around the same time that scared people to thinking it was real. And Dracula did the same thing. Real places, real people, based on real events, with this Eastern European count arriving into Whitby and taking all the right trains you would at train stations with the same addresses. It scared the heck out of people.
And you know,
with mixed reviews.
Dracula was now, you know, today we take it for granted, but was it the first book ever written about vampires?
No, actually, it wasn't. And that's something that people do think. There was a couple before that. The first one was written by John Polidori, which is a sort of a tragic story. He was Lord Byron's doctor. And Byron and Polidori and Mary Shelley and Percy Shelley all went to Geneva, Switzerland.
Oh, the famous story, yeah.
1916 for a holiday. And there had been a massive earthquake the year before in Indonesia that set up this dust cloud that moved around the world that altered the weather patterns of the world. Even in America, if you look at almanacs, you'll see when that cloud came around, a lot of our weather patterns had changed, a lot of more rain, not much sun, and it changed dramatically this summer in Geneva, Switzerland, and it caused that house party, who were all there for the good weather, stay indoors and write those stories. And that's where Mary Shelley started writing Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. That's where Lord Byron took a stab at a vampire story, got bored with it. His doctor, John Polidori, finished it, or wrote most of it, 90%, they say. Byron got the first credits for it because Polidori was a no one to the publishers, and a court battle ensued. Polidori got the rights back, and so that's the vampire. And then Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu, a fellow Irishman who actually was an editor of the newspaper that Bram wrote his theatrical reviews for, wrote Carmilla, which is a vampire story about female vampires in Austria. And then J. Malcolm Reimer wrote Varney the Vampire. So those books, three books, predated Dracula. But what was different about Dracula, it struck home.
There was something about Dracula, there was something about Dracula that just people just took to. It scared, like you say, scared the heck out of them.
Yeah, for sure.
So I want to ask you about the some of these. You say some things were found recently in some libraries, some lost, maybe some lost information about Dracula. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely, I'd be happy to, because the book was written between 1890 and 1897. Bram didn't keep an autobiography. He kept notes. They're in the Rosenbach Museum in Philadelphia. They'd been discovered. A typescript was discovered, and that's now owned by Paul Allen. Paul Allen is dead. He passed away a few years ago, but he makes that available to scholars, and I've had a chance, along with J.D. Barker, when we were actually doing our research for our prequel to Dracula a couple of years ago. That's been discovered in a barn in Pennsylvania, and that's an interesting long story. But the most recent one has been because a fellow by the name of Philip Spedding, who was working for the London Library, and he was a big fan of Dracula. He knew that Bram Stoker was a member of this library, and he also had a published copy of the Dracula notes that my two friends, Elizabeth Miller and Robert 18 Bassang, who just passed away a few days ago, published these notes. And he looked at the back of the note, and luckily Bram, sort of like a good student, listed his resources. And it triggered a thought in Philip's brain, thinking, well, I know Bram was a member here during the time of writing Dracula. I wonder if any of these books are here. And so he walked through the aisle. Sure enough, Denny, he found 28 of these books. And he actually contacted me and Robert 18 the same to see if we could verify by sending us photos some of the material in the book, some of the photos of the books, and we actually discovered that Bran had written notes in the margins of the book. And that told me specifically what caught Bran's eye. What was he thinking of? What was it in these books that he then transferred into his notes? And then, furthermore, transferred into the novel. And I'll just tell you this, because I can't tell everything about all 28 books in the time we have. But what jumped out at me, and I'll read you one passage. What jumped out at me was the fact that Bram was looking for some far-off land, not too far away from civilization, but a deep, dark land. And he found it. There was one book called Land Beyond the Forest, written by a Scottish lady that Bram's neighbor, Emily Gerard, wrote, and his neighbor was Mark Twain. Mark Twain, the writer, introduced this book to Bram, and that focused him in Pennsylvania. But further to that, he was looking at one book called The Other World, Glimpses of the Supernatural Being Facts, Records, and Tradition, written by Reverend Frederick George Lee. But just imagine a reverend, a man of the church, writing about the supernatural. And this couple sentences I'm going to read to you was actually marked by Bram. Commonly held that in lonely deserts, on lofty mountains, where the feet of men seldom tread, as well as in the mines of the earth, and in vast forests where desolation reigns, the powers of the devil and his angels being unchecked and uncurbed by the positive energizing activity of Christianity are vast. Now, to me, because that is definitely marked off in his pencil, it points to forests, mines, and the devil, lofty mountains. So in his notes, he actually wrote coordinates, and that led me to northeastern Transylvania. And then that's why this passage makes sense. Because when you analyze the other things in the books, they were all pointing to the playground of the devil, and that volcanoes were known to be homes of the supernatural god in the subterranean earth. So what Bram was looking for was a place that the devil would essentially hang out. And to finish that thought, which put it all together for me, the original ending for Dracula had a volcanic eruption right after Dracula was stabbed in the heart and he turned into dust. Readers don't know this, but when I got a chance to look at that typescript that was out in Seattle, crossed out and edited out, was the volcanic eruption. So here you have the place for the devil to go back down into his hole in the middle of the earth,
it wasn't just Bram's belief, that was a commonly held belief. This was the devil's portal. So these books really helped us give us an idea of what Bram was thinking of. There was another book by a Dr. Mayo, but it was actually chapters on vampirism, unreal ghosts, trances, trance sleeping, half walking. This is Lucy when she did her her sleepwalking in Whitby. This is, I mean, there was an actual chapter on vampirism and the belief that it's not crazy. It's a real belief, and this was written by a medical doctor. So Brent took his own sort of ideas of folklore and superstition, but they were backed up by a reverend and by a medical doctor, and the whole thing came together quite nicely for him. So now when I look at the novel, I realize that there's more to just pure fantasy that Uncle Bram was writing about. This was something that he was really making this sound like a realistic novel based on real facts.
We're going to take a real quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk about some of the places where he wrote this book. And you said he worked on it for 7 years. And that's not a long time for some people, work longer on books, but it still seemed like it was, a long time to be occupied with a vampire on your mind.
Sure is.
And then we're going to talk about some of the influences, the real life influences behind the legend of Dracula.
Listen to them, children of the night. What music they make.
I want to talk to you for just a minute about our sponsorship ads. And we're doing things a little bit different now than what we've done in the past, because my time is so limited, and I know everyone out there in the business community is hurting right now in these hard times. So we've come up with a deal I think anybody should be able to take advantage of. It's only going to cost you $20 a year and a business card. Yes, my overhead is pretty low, and I can do it right now at $20 and a business card. Now this is going to get you some mention ads in rotation on our Wonder Mag On Air radio show, internet radio show, and also on our Facebook pages. We have two or three that we advertise our show on and different things going on within the Wondering Press. So folks, I hope you can take advantage of this, and we're going to be talking about it from time to time on here, because I really want to work with you, and I want to keep advertising some businesses and keep my show going, because I don't need a lot of money to keep it going, but I don't want to do it for free, because my time's worth something too. So if you want to get a hold of us, you know how to do that. And if you don't, I'm going to tell you right now, you can just write to me if you still like to write letters and send a check with it for $20 and a business card. Or anyway, it's Wondering Press, Post Office Box 153, Grayville, Illinois, 62844. That's Wondering Press, Post Office Box 153, Grayville, Illinois, 62844. Or you can call me, Denny Reese, at 618-375-1367. That's 618-375-1367. And I'll come see you wherever you may be located. And you want to email me? Do that at wandermag2003@yahoo.com. That's WANDERMAG2003, the number, at yahoo.com. And I don't know. I'd like to keep this going for a long time, because I think I can right now. I'd like to build a studio someday, and I probably will with your help and support. But right now, with all these hard times going on, I think this is the best deal we can do for you. $20 and a business card. We've already got some people signed up, and you pay your $20, you're in for a year. And we won't bother you, we won't call you and say, hey, we may want updates or want to know what's going on with your business. If you want me to talk about something on the air, I will. But right now, that's the way we're doing it. $20 and a business card. Be a member. Be a sponsor of Wonder Mag On Air.
Thank you.
Okay, Dacre. Now, most writers, you know, they can write in a lot of different places, but he had a couple of places where he wrote the majority of Dracula, and I want you to tell us about those two places, if you will.
Absolutely. You know, as we mentioned earlier in the show, he was a very busy man with this job running and managing the Lyceum Theater, being Henry Irving's sort of personal assistant. So, I mean, he not only had a day job, but he had a night job as well. And afterwards, they always had to entertain the patrons at his private sort of dinner club. So Brand did most of his writing on his holidays. In a strange way, also, he had free time in his hands when they crossed the Atlantic, because he brought the Lyceum Theater folks over to America 8 times. That means 16 Atlantic crossings. But the two places that really jump out at me and most of the scholars is that he visited the lovely fishing village in Yorkshire called Whitby. It's a coastal town, obviously, it's a fishing village, but it's got a beautiful ambiance to it. Mm-hmm. And when Brand went there in 1890, it was just when he was getting started with his notes. Luckily, he did date some of them. But the influence of the town of Whitby was huge, because prior to that, we see in his very early notes, he was thinking of placing the story in Styria, which was a province of Austria, which would have been following logically with where Mr. Sheridan Fanu had Camilla. So he got here to Whitby and he went to the library. We know these facts because there were signed out books, and he signed his name and the books that he looked at. And one of those books by William Wilkinson, The Accounts of Principalities in Wallachia and Moldavia, pointed out this Prince Dracula, and that Dracula was known as being a name for somebody who displayed courage and cunning. And was also known as the dragon, the devil.
So that's where the name
and
came
so
from.
That's where the name came from. It was backed up in the London Library, who had the same book, and then a second book by Jane Samuelson, who also mentioned the connection between Dracula and the devil. So the name, we can say, is because of Whitby and the London Library, but it makes such an impression on him, this holiday, this two-week holiday in the summer, that he actually placed chapter 6, 7, and 8 there. And as you go visit there, and I've been there, you know, 10 times at least, there's 2 festivals a year, Gothic festivals. People wander around the town recreating the steps of Lucy and Mina as they go from one side of the town across the harbor bridge to up the 199 steps to the other side. They had the real shipwreck of the Demeter. That was the Dimitri, and Brand simply turned it into the Demeter. Brand has records in his notes of talking to Coast Guard men, sailors, fishermen about weather patterns, dialect, and they've got this actual account of the wreck of the Dimitri that he turned into the Demeter. So there's no question that the town of Whitby Abbey and St. Mary's Church, the location where Brand stayed, the same a boarding house was the same place Lucy and Nina stayed. So all these sort of check all the boxes of this town was where he gathered a lot of information, took a lot of notes. But we think that was just where he took all the notes. But the actual writing process, for those of you listening who are authors, you know, you take a lot of notes for a long time, and then you flesh them out, and you actually sit down somewhere that's quiet, not to be bothered, still somewhat of a stimulating environment, but a few hundred miles up the coast into northern Scotland was this lovely fishing village called Cruden Bay. And Bran went up there on his own and then told his son and wife to take the train and come and join him, because he's found this idyllic little place called Cruden Bay. And I've been there myself now twice, plan to go back because it's a really neat place and it really hasn't changed too much. But the same hotel is there that Brand stayed in, and his signature's in the guest book, the same little fishing village at the end of the 2 Mile Beach where he was actually there, Denny, 13 years.
Wow, sounds like a throwback in time to me. It sounds like it's, you know, when you go back there, it's like going back in time.
It was. And a fellow by the name of Mike Shepherd wrote a book about Brand's time there. They found all the records of where he was, newspaper accounts. And what's really, really cool, and the thing I really want to share with your listeners, is not only did he have the right place to write, he actually wrote two other books while he was there, all based on events in local folklore and stories, but the castle. Castle Dracula is obviously a fictional castle.
Mm-hmm.
The folks in Romania love to kind of earmark Bran Castle as Dracula's castle.
Well, so there is actually a one. They have one that they use for a tourist attraction, don't they? You're talking about that one?
Yes. Yeah. They do. And what I want to say is it's a Bran merged, both Bran Castle in Brasov with Swain's Castle in Cruden Bay, Scotland. And this is why I know that he did it. Two of the books in the London Library contain sketches of Bran Castle. And Bran was a painter in his free time, not as accomplished as he was a writer in his free time, but he did paint. And he wrote, he described things with the eye of a painter. And I am convinced that when he sat down to describe the appearance of Bran Castle in northern Transylvania, he looked at these two sketches, because as I look at them and I see his words to describe them, they look exactly like these sketches. But he was never there, so he wouldn't have gotten inside. When you read chapter 2 of Dracula, and you look at what I usually show in my Stoker on Stoker presentations, you look at the drone footage of Swain's castle, you can see there is an octagonal room in the middle of this building, this castle, not with no windows to the outside, and lit by a single lamp. That's exactly how Bran described it in the novel. And we don't have a record of him stepping inside Swain's castle, but that's not that usual. But it was usual for the Earl, in this case the Earl of Errol, would have invited in any famous people or well-known people, and Bran was well-known enough over his 13 years, he would have been invited inside Swain's castle. He would have had this visual, and he probably even took notes of what it was like, because I've been inside it. It's a ruin now. And as I read, the Count halted, putting down my bags, closed the door, crossed the room, opened another door, which led into a single octagonal room lit by a single lamp, which seemingly without a window of any sort. Passing through this, he opened another door, motioned me to enter. It was a welcome sight. I experienced that myself. So this is good old Bran using what he had at his disposal to create the perfect fictional Castle Dracula. He simply placed it, Denny, on an extinct volcano. Why is that? As I mentioned earlier, he planned to have a volcanic eruption at the end of the story. Mm-hmm. So it all comes together that way, with fact and fiction all blended in together.
Now, when he was writing Dracula, did he already have a publisher, or was he writing this book and then going to try to get it published?
He had written other books before. He was well known in the publishing world, but the story we think is that he went to Otto Kalman, the editor at Archibald Constable in London, and he shot Otto Kalman with a very realistic preface and a very realistic story, and Kalman, we think, told him to go back and tone it down a little bit. Don't have time here to read the original preface, but if any of you listeners are interested, just Google Richard Dalby, who's the guy that found the original preface,
Dalby,
in, ironically, the Icelandic version of Dracula, which has been unearthed by a friend of mine, Hans de Roos, as an alternate version of Dracula, published in Iceland in 1901. I believe it could have been an early version that was too horrific, too violent, too sexual, a little political even. And it's possible that the translator actually took some liberties. It's possible that it was an early version that Bran didn't get published and he had to tone it down, as I said. Who knows? But what's cool is it adds another level of mystery to the Dracula lore. But yes, Otto Kalman was his editor, and Bran had other books published there as well, with Kalman at the helm later in life.
Now we hear the name Count Dracula, so I guess the character was aristocratic or descended from royalty?
Vlad the Impaler,
yes.
Vlad Tepesh, was this Wallachian prick, not Transylvania, that was right next door, a province next door, but these two books that I mentioned earlier in the show, the one by Wilkinson and the one by Samuelson, mentioned that this guy was a prince. He was known as a brutal ruler. He was known for paling people and doing all sorts of other horrible atrocities.
He was a terrible person, yeah.
But when I had been, I've been there now many times in Transylvania for research and leading tours, the people there really accepted his atrocities as a necessary evil for unifying a very violent country during a very violent part of history against a hugely powerful army, the Ottoman Empire, across the Black Sea. So little old Romania, which was made up of Moldavia, Wallachia, Transylvania, squeezed in between the shores of the Black Sea and the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, were constantly being overrun by these huge powers, and they were constantly having to either pay a ransom to one side or the other, or have an allegiance with one side or the other. They were totally crushed. What they had at their advantage is brutal rulers like Vlad the Impaler or his father, and the fact that this was a mountainous country, and they could sort of, guard the narrow mountain passes where they wouldn't be outnumbered so badly, and also they practiced guerrilla warfare, and also some of these horrific scare tactics like impaling and boiling people and so on. So he wasn't the kind of guy you'd want to sit down with and have a comfortable dinner with if you were his enemy.
So I'm guessing
if you were on his good side, you were okay for
him. I'm guessing he's probably met a pretty bloody end.
He did. He actually with his final battle, apparently, he had his head cut off by either his own people or the enemy, and his head brought back to Constantinople because he was a constant thorn in the side to Sultan Mehmed.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, nobody really knows where his body is. There is kind of an interesting cottage industry in Romania, leading tourists to, his body is here at Snagov Monastery, or his body is over here at Cremona Monastery, but, his head, it was brought back to Constantinople, and maybe it's somehow been brought back to Italy somewhere and in a vault.
Well,
nobody really knows, but that's what keeps the mystery alive.
So he basically didn't say this Dracula was Vlad the Impaler, but that's sort of one of the people he based him on.
Yes. I mean, the thing that people have to realize is when you read in the novel how Van Helsing explained the history of Count Dracula, there's a heck of a lot of similarities to Vlad's own, but he didn't come out and say it, but it just sounds like it. What's happened since the novel, and since many movies have decided to make that connection, the 1992 movie by Francis Ford Coppola and written by Jim Hart, they make that connection, as do some others. But it wasn't Brand that actually solidified it. It was years later in these movies.
Mm-hmm. So he had a brother who was, Thornley
yep.
Stoker? I mean, your Bram's brother.
Oh, Bram's brother. Yeah, Thornley Stoker was a great help to Bram. We knew he was a very famous doctor. He was also knighted because he was the head of the Royal College of Surgeons of Dublin. But when I analyzed the Dracula typescript, I could see Thornley's handwriting correcting Bram and directing him to modify how he was writing so he could get all the medical parts of Dracula just right. And even in Bram's Dracula notes, Thornley actually drew the way to do the brain surgery on Renfield in chapter 21, because he had actually done that surgery himself, brain trepanation.
Well, I'm wondering if he might have been the inspiration for Van Helsing.
It's funny, I think he was more the inspiration for Seward, because Seward was both a medical doctor and also the psychiatrist. Van Helsing, there was a little bit maybe of Thornley there, but some people think, and I'm sort of ambivalent to this guy Max Mueller, who was a professor and also a doctor that Seward studied under, and it's possible that Thornley studied under him. So Bram was a master of merging all kinds of people. I think Matilda his sister was a lot like Nina, as was his mother. So I think Bran was a lot like Harker. So there's a lot of these mergings of different characteristics of people, just like he did the castle, to make get just the right effect.
And I think that happens with a lot of books. And then, of course, over time, they develop their own legends. Of course, there's no...
Yeah.
In horror, that Dracula is next to Frankenstein. Is probably the two biggest legends in the horror genre, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Werewolves are right in there with them somewhere. But
Bran even had the presence of werewolves in his novel. You know, people don't always look that closely to it, but the Count Frank morphed into a werewolf at the London Zoo, and some of the research books that Bran listed, one of them was the Book of Werewolves by the Dean Baring Gould. So I wouldn't say he invented the werewolf, but he certainly inserted it into the novel.
Yeah,
and he should get a little credit for that.
He was able to turn himself into different kinds of animals and beasts besides bats, if I remember right.
Bats, rat,
mm-hmm.
The mist, the wolf, and then the big black dog when they arrived in the Whitby. So Dracula was pretty elusive and pretty powerful to be able to do that.
But could you say that Bram Stoker probably invented some of the ideas that we have about vampires with the garlic and they can't be in the daylight and the sign of a crucifix drives them crazy and things like that?
Well, I wouldn't say Bram invented it, but he utilized it.
Okay.
Where he got it from is interesting. As I mentioned earlier, again in the show, it was Emily Gerard's book, The Land Beyond the Forest, a two-volume book that went into great detail in an essay she had in there called Transylvanian Superstitions. Again, what Bran did was she listed all these different superstitions in different parts of the country, and he sort of, again, merged them all to become sort of everything in one pile, the super superstitions in one guy. And that's where he got it from. So he, again, he didn't just think it up out of nowhere. He was using, Danny, real superstitions that
existed. I'm guessing he researched this and found, like you said, found these superstitions.
Yes, absolutely. That's what made it so real, is that, it was in people's minds. This wasn't just pulled out of fantasy world. There were treaties about vampires floating around since the 1700s when the plague would go through Europe. So, again, it wasn't just something that he developed out of incredible imagination. It was sort of in the consciousness of people. And in a newspaper article that he actually gave an interview to, the interviewer said, "Where did you get all this from?" He said, "Well, it's just all kinds of research, but it combines mystery and fact from the Middle Ages. What countries?" And he listed like 13 different countries that he could find that had the sort of folklore of the vampire.
And now I want to ask you, do you believe that there are people in some of these countries to this day that still believe in the legend of vampires?
Well, I can tell you this. I appeared on a PBS documentary a couple of years ago, and it was a British film crew that were making it. It was called Secrets of the Dead, the Vampire Legend. It's great, and
okay.
you can find it on the
I may have actually seen that. Yeah, I think I saw that.
And they actually found in 2004 in Romania a group of guys that found that this young lady was very, very ill, and they suspected that this man was coming out of the grave and taking her spirit, and taking her life force.
Uh-huh.
And they got permission from the wife to open up the grave, cut open the man's chest, the dead man's chest, take out the heart, bring it to the crossroads, just like the old superstitions would say, burn it, create a sort of a tea potion out of it, and feed it to the young lady, and she recovered, just like they did back in the old days.
Wow.
And these things were in Bram's notes, where this actually, he had notes of this happening in New England.
It happened.
In the late 1800s. Huh. So, these superstitions die hard. And there may be people still this day in some of these remote areas that don't have all the great enlightenment and education to prove otherwise. But these kind of thoughts have lasted a long time.
I got one more question. We were talking, you might have covered some of this earlier, about some of the missing pages from the original Dracula manuscript. What's been discovered that you think makes it complete?
The
volcano?
This will be a little Halloween treat for your listeners. I can tell you unequivocally that, having now analyzed
typescript and worked on an annotated version of Dracula with one of the best noted scholars in the world, Robert J. Keane, to say that the short story, Dracula's Guest, which is only 17 pages long, and Bran's widow published this 2 years after Bran died. She found it in his papers. That was no question that was part of the original Dracula manuscript. And the reason I say that so confidently is that the manuscript, the typescript starts on page 102. So 101 pages is missing. When I look through that typescript with J.D. Barker, we were looking for things that were crossed out. Because, of course, those are things you don't get to read because they weren't published.
Mm-hmm.
And we found three very distinct passages that were referring to situations that happened in this short story, Dracula's Guest, published by Bran's widow. So that means to me, Bran had to edit it for length, cut out the 101 pages, and then had to go through the rest of the typescript and cross out anything that would have happened in there, otherwise it wouldn't have made any sense. Furthermore to that, in the preface to Dracula's Guest that your listeners can get online free on Gutenberg or any published book that has it, Bran's widow said, this story was edited out of my husband's most famous work for length.
Well, I want to thank you for your time today, Zachary Stoker, and I mean, we'll get you back on here today because not today, but we'll get you back on sometime because you didn't even get a chance to talk about any of your books.
We'll save that for another time.
Okay.
But you know, your people can find me either by going to BramStokerEstate.com. My books are out there as well as some cool, interesting artifacts that we have, and even a Bram Stoker bobblehead we're now selling. Brands in pop culture, just like Dracula. My books are out there, Dracul, which is a prequel to Dracula, and Dracula the Undead, which is a sequel. So thank you, Denny, for having me on. I hope all your listeners have a wonderful and scary and appropriate Halloween this season.
Thank you very much.
Oh, there's a crazy little shack beyond the tracks. Everybody calls it the Sugar Shack. Well, it's just a coffee house and it's made out of wood. Espresso coffee tastes mighty good. That's not the reason why I gotta get back up to that Sugar Shack. Oh, baby, to that Sugar Shack. Oh, there's this cute little girlie's.
Not exactly the Sugar Shack, but I want to tell you about a great little shop near Grayville where you can get the snacks and drinks you need for your country drive. Judge's Snack Shack is now open on Webb's Ferry Road. They have ice cold drinks, chips, fresh farm eggs, honey, candy, ice cream, microwave foods, and much more. It's such a stone's throw from the Wabash River on Webb's Ferry Road, and Judge's Snack Shack never closes. It's open day and night on the honor system. All items are priced for your convenience. So it's a fine time for a drive through the country and a perfect time to stop by the Snack Shack where the treats are waiting for you. Well, I certainly hope you've learned something from today's show.
Van Helsing. Now that you have learned what you have learned, it would be well for you to return to your own country.
Thanks for being a part of Wonder Bag on Air, episode 81. And listening to my interview with Dacre Stoker, the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula. You remember Dracula, don't you? He was that bloodsucker from Transylvania. And it's getting close to Halloween. We got a great show next week coming up with Carrie Bible. She's a tour guide at Hollywood Forever Cemetery. This is Denny Reese, and I'm going to close out with a song you may not know, but it's by a guy named Roki Erickson. And it's very appropriate. It's called Night of the Vampire.